Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Mario Valencia. I represent Jonathan Roberts in this case.
Let's move your microphone just a little bit up so we can, not only we can hear you, but it's, we can record it.
Okay. Thanks. Now I'd like to reserve, if I can, maybe 2 minutes for rebuttal at the end. Mr. Roberts raises, in essence, three or four issues on appeal. He is contending that his rights to a speedy trial were violated, both under the Speedy Trial Act and his Sixth Amendment right to a speedy trial. He also is disputing on appeal the district court's denial of a motion that he filed to suppress some evidence obtained without a warrant from some cell phones. And the last issue on appeal was some improper closing argument statements made by the prosecutor during closing argument that talked about the presumption of innocence and shifted the burden of proof, we believe, over to the defendant. So I'll start out with the speedy trial violation. Mr. Roberts was arrested on May 3, 2005. He was indicted on May 11, 2005, but he was not brought to trial until August 21 of 2006. The whole time, Mr. Roberts was in jail. He could not afford counsel, so he was appointed an attorney to represent him in the case. And initially, the trial was set to go, I believe, on July 11th. The first stipulation that was filed on July 5.
I think we know the factual background. Which continuances do you emphasize to us as being improperly counted as improperly excluded under the speedy trial clock?
Well, for sure, we dispute the continuances in 2006. Pretty much all of them. The trial was continued, I believe, January 19th.
And there was a joint request for trial continuance, right?
Yes. It was a stipulation that was submitted.
And the stipulation didn't expressly state that the defendants had consented, unlike some of the other stipulations, right?
That is correct.
So why is that fatal if defense counsel is representing or making the motion without expressly saying the stipulation?
Why is it fatal if defense counsel doesn't put in there that the defendants are stipulating?
Well, consenting.
Consenting.
There's a difference.
Right.
If the defendant consents.
Yes. Personally, I believe that it's fatal because they're in prison, and the whole purpose for the speedy trial right is, as the Supreme Court has noted, is not to basically, you know, preserve memories and everything for trial. It's because you have a defendant who's sitting in jail pending a determination, really, as to their guilt or innocence. And they're sitting there waiting to go to trial. And in this case, particularly where you have a defendant who began asserting that right in October of the year before and claiming that his attorney wouldn't discuss this case with him, wouldn't discuss the continual postponements and delays of the case with him, it becomes fatal in that context to say that.
You would argue for a strict rule that if the stipulation filed for a continuance does not affirmatively state that the defendant consents, that that time is not excludable.
Well, if I did, I think I would be going contrary to the language of the statute in the Speedy Trial Act. 18 U.S.C. 3161 H8A says the court on its own motion can also continue the trial if certain things are followed. So in that context, no, the defendant's consent would not be necessary. But I certainly would argue, and that is the argument we're making in this case, when you have a defendant who is represented by court-appointed counsel, and as we pointed out in our case, is continually moving to continue the trial for different reasons, and is doing really nothing on the case for over a year, then certainly in the context of this case, it was important for that attorney to have consulted with the defendant, to have discussed why the continuances were necessary, and to have put in there whether or not the defendant consented. Our argument on that point is that Mr. Roberts didn't consent and has always maintained that he did not consent to the continual postponements of the trial date. And I say in there are different reasons, and I just quickly would like to point out that the first stipulation says defense counsel needs more time to review discovery. The second stipulation was in September, and it has similar language, and it says that discovery is still being provided to the defendants, and they will need more time to review that. In October, the trial is continued again. This is of 2005. They go in, and they have calendar call, and what they tell the judge at that point in time is that there have been let me see here. I want to get it right.
But all those continuances were obtained with a statement that the defendants understood and consented and understood that the time was excludable, right?
They were. Now, here's the interesting part about the October continuance. To answer your question directly, yes, they were continued with a stipulation eventually that said that the defendants agreed. However,
it's hard to argue that should be included.
It's hard to argue that should be included?
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, like I was saying, in this case, I don't think, honestly, if you're going just strictly under the Speedy Trial Act, that the defendant's consent is required, except for that in this circuit, if you don't consent, let me put it the other way around, if you do consent, it becomes much more difficult, which is the government's argument in this case. If you do consent, even if you consent, as the government argues in this case, through counsel, your counsel acts on his own, you should still be held to that attorney's representations, and then you're precluded from ever being able to raise that on appeal, like we're doing now. That's their whole argument. They're saying, well, you consented to it. It said it right there. So because your counsel said you did and you wanted the continuance, you're bound by that. You can't raise that on appeal. So in that context, it does become necessary, you know, to determine whether or not, in fact, a defendant did or didn't consent to these cases. But there is Ninth Circuit case law that this Court's very familiar with. You have written the opinion on some of them, dealing with the Speedy Trial Act, where a defendant did, in fact, personally sign off on that stipulation or was in court and understood exactly what they were doing, yet they were still allowed to raise that issue later on appeal. So strictly under the Speedy Trial Act, it is hard to argue that would have to be in every stipulation. However, it is a relevant factor to be able to preserve the issue for later review.
Your time's starting to tick down.
Yes.
Would you mind addressing the motion to suppress issue in the cell phone?
Yes. Our contention on that, and I don't think the facts are disputed, at least they weren't on appeal, is at the time that Mr. Roberts was arrested, he is inside of the hotel. Outside is the car that was involved in transporting the kidnapped victim there. They search the vehicle, don't completely search it, then they put that vehicle in valet. They hadn't completed the search yet. The police do that. Later on, they complete the search. I believe that the two cell phones that were recovered at the time that the car was still at the hotel. But they search in a center console of the vehicle, and they pull out these cell phones that are in the center console, two Sprint cell phones. They then take them back, and they book them into evidence. And then, by the testimony of the agent in this case, nothing is done on those things for about a month or two. He then pulls the cell phones out, again without a search warrant, and looks through the content of them and finds a video that he believes is relevant to the case and ultimately was for the government. They presented it at the trial. They cross-examined their agent on it. They cross-examined Mr. Roberts on it, and then they played it during closing argument to the jury. So it was relevant to their case. Mr. Roberts' counsel, the second attorney that he got appointed that ultimately took this case to trial, filed a motion to suppress evidence, the evidence that was on the cell phones that was obtained without a warrant. The argument that he made in the district court was the same. They didn't have a warrant. They should not have been able to search the cell phones. However, the argument focused on the fact that they didn't have a warrant to search the car, and so then the content of the cell phone shouldn't be admitted into evidence. At trial, when they admitted the evidence or tried to admit the evidence again, defense counsel objected to that evidence coming in, renewing his objection. So on appeal, our argument is, and I believe it's undisputed, is that they didn't have a warrant. The evidence, the videotape that they got, the video clip from the cell phone, should have been suppressed because they could have obtained a warrant. The argument on appeal from the government is that we've waived that. And they cite to Respeta Rua, I think is how you pronounce it, to say, well, you waived that claim. I have two arguments in response to that. Is this is the same claim we're making. It's a different argument. But it's the same claim. And the cases that they cite, in our opinion, are in opposite. In the district court, they might have argued that there was a lack of probable cause, and then they contend on appeal that the search was unconstitutional because there was a dog there. Or they argue there was the search shouldn't, it was illegal, and then they come up here and they argue there was no probable cause. In this case, the claim is exactly the same. There was a search that was illegal of those cell phones because there was no search warrant. That's the same. The only argument that is different is that the search warrant should have been for the phones and not just for the car.
Well, the argument below was that they needed a search warrant for the car and they didn't obtain one.
Exactly.
There's no argument made that they needed a specific search warrant for the phones.
There was not.
Now on appeal you're arguing, wait a minute, actually what they needed was a search warrant for the phones. So you're actually making this argument for the first time on appeal.
The argument that the search warrant had to be for the phones, yes.
Okay.
Yeah. It's being raised for the first time on appeal. The other argument that we have in rebuttal is, and they admit there, that this court can still consider such claims, even if they are waived, for good cause shown or for cause shown. We would argue, and it's not in the brief, but that cause is shown in this case. And the reason for that is this attorney, this new attorney that came on the case, literally gets appointed June 26th. He has to go to trial August 21. In that short time period, he does everything the prior counsel who had this case for a year didn't do. He files motions to suppress. He presents a defense that, according to prior counsel, he didn't want to present. He files a motion to dismiss for lack of for violation of the speedy trial rights and my client's Sixth Amendment rights. He does all of that. They have a hearing on this motion August 17th, just a few days before trial begins. And at that hearing, for the first time, as far as I can tell from the record, is when it's presented during testimony of the agent on the stand that it took him 2 months to look into these cell phones to determine whether or not, you know, there was evidence in them and whether they were going to present that or not. Before that,
they need a search warrant for the phones.
Why did they?
Yeah.
I believe for the same reasons stated by the district courts, U.S. district courts, in the two cases we cited, LaSalle and Park, and that is
the time delay?
Not only the time delay, for sure the time delay, but the fact is that there is no exception either. The Fourth Amendment specifically says you need a search warrant. There are a few exceptions. There is no automobile exception. There was no exception that there was some sort of danger posed by the cell phones. There was no exception that it was found on his person and so was immediately there, or there was a possibility that the evidence would be destroyed. None of the exceptions that typically apply as to why you don't need a search warrant.
Why doesn't the vehicle exception apply?
Because they're on the cell phones, and the cell phones have their own content. As the courts in those cases have stated, these are now computers, literally walking computers that you have. It would be the same arguments as to why you couldn't just go into somebody's PC immediately and start taking information out. I think the cell phones are sort of like the locked box they were saying at the end of the bed. They're their own content, their own special container. And they're, like I said, the rule is usually you get a search warrant, and there has to be an exclusion for it. And the automobile exception or one of those others just doesn't apply in this case, nor have they contended that it does.
You have about a minute left. You want to reserve?
And
we understand you have the third issue, but we've read the briefs, and we'll give you a little time for rebuttal if the government raises it.
Good morning. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Olson on behalf of the United States. I'll start with the cell phone search issue, since that was of interest to the panel. The claim that the defendant made in the district court was that the evidence obtained from the car should be suppressed because the police did not get a search warrant to search the car when it was in the valet parking area outside the ransom victim drop-off site. That claim that they were making is simply foreclosed by decades of Supreme Court Ninth Circuit law. You don't need, if you have probable cause, if the police have probable cause at the time to believe either that that there's evidence of the crime or, well, officer safety is an issue. One thing to keep in mind, at the time that they initially, you know, the kidnappers brought the victim to the hotel, brought him inside. The FBI was there, the police was there, they took him down. So now they've got the victim recovered and they've got two defendants in custody. They don't know how many defendants there are. They don't know what else is going on. They go out and they search the car. Now, in the district court, the only argument that the defendant made was that the police needed a search warrant to do that. And that's simply incorrect. They don't need a search warrant to do that.
So it was a rather cut and dried
Absolutely.
Issue. So, you know, Judge McKibben is one of our finest district judges, very contemplative, but he was never presented directly with, regardless of why, you know, the rushed lawyer or whatever, he was never presented the opportunity to make a decision as to whether Ninth Circuit law should be extended, at least from a district court perspective, to the issue of whether a separate search warrant should be obtained for cell phones, which, as we know today, include things like iPhones, Blackberries. I mean, counsel is quite correct. These are not just cell phones. These are personal computers.
In this case, it was a video clip. I mean, it was a video clip of the victim found, but yes.
Generically speaking, cell phones today are just not devices by which people send and receive telephone calls.
Exactly.
I mean, people have their calendars in there. They have personal information in there, very private information in there.
I have all that on mine.
So
it's true.
In fairness to Judge McKibben, he was never presented with that issue, was he?
Exactly. And it's an interesting issue. I mean, if there's a reason that motions to suppress and the grounds for those motions.
Well, that's not exactly in the rule. Rule 12, it just says the motion to suppress must be filed.
Right. The rule says the motion to suppress must be filed.
His argument basically is that Rule 12 requires a motion to suppress to be filed. He filed it, or the trial counsel filed it, and he's giving a different reason, which may or may not be in our discretion.
Yes.
I'm not sure it's a Rule 12 violation particularly.
No, well, I think that this Court's decisions in Restrepo Rua, in Murillo, and in Wright, in all three of those cases.
That was the dog case, right? I mean, there was no motion to suppress at all filed in that one, right?
No, I think that the holding in those cases, though, I mean, the statement of law is this Court has interpreted Rule 12, and I quote, just as a failure to file a timely motion to suppress evidence constitutes a waiver, so too does a failure to raise a particular ground in support of a motion to suppress. Now, the Ninth Circuit has said that in numerous cases, and obviously the panel is bound by that if that's an issue that needs to be taken in bank and be reconsidered. Obviously, that's something the defendant could seek to do.
Well, he wanted to suppress all evidence recovered from the vehicle, correct?
Yes. And as it turns out, the only, I would have to go back and check, but I believe that the only evidence from the vehicle that ended up getting admitted at trial was the video clip of the victim restrained. And you know, the other argument that we make is that evidence, although more graphic than the testimony, was simply cumulative. I mean, the video showed the defendant with his jeans, with his legs bound in duct tape, his wrists bound in twist ties, with a shirt over his head laying on the floor of the defendant's apartment. The victim testified that's how he was restrained. At least two of the other co-defendants and perhaps all three testified that there was duct tape on the leg.
They were cooperating.
Right, at that point they were cooperating, which is one of the reasons there was a fairly lengthy pretrial delay here, and I think part of that was because defendants were being added, defendants were deciding to cooperate, and there was a lot of changes as the case
evolved. Putting aside the potential waiver issue or the problem and the harmlessness issue on the other end, why didn't they need a warrant?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question, and frankly, I didn't brief it because I think that, you know, either they waived it or it was harmless. On the merits of whether they needed a separate search warrant to look inside a cell phone.
A month to 2 months after they initially searched the vehicle.
Yeah, and frankly, that two-month delay really bolsters our argument that this is a different ground because they're not saying you needed a search warrant to search the car. Now they're making a very different argument that you need a search warrant to search the cell phone.
We understand your waiver argument, but we're curious about the merits.
Thank you. Well, you know, I'll tell you, I think one of the questions that I would have and would be interested to explore is whether exceptions, you know, there's a rule, there's the container rule, right? If police have probable cause or a warrant to search for something, they can search any container in which that information can be found, right? Now, this court recently extended that rule or reaffirmed that rule applies to a computer. In that case, the search of the house, there was a search warrant to search the house looking for some financial records and some other records. What the police found was a computer. And the question is whether it was okay under the container rule to search the computer. And the court said that it was. Of course, in that case, the police actually did take the extra step of getting a separate warrant. But that it was. Now, in this case, because there wasn't a warrant, the question is whether that, first of all, the first question will be whether the automobile exception, which allows them to search the car for specific evidence of an ongoing crime, would allow them to search the cell phone. The fact that it was a month later sitting in an evidence room somewhere when they finally went and looked at it, you know, I think the better practice, and you know, I would have advised the police to get a separate warrant for it. Sure, I would have, you know. But at the end of the day, A, it wasn't raised, and B, if you look at all the evidence in trial, it was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. I mean, there were numerous victims, the victim and numerous co-defendants who testified consistently about the drug deal gone bad, the resulting kidnapping, and all of the details. There's physical evidence that corroborated the testimony of the
I'll tell you this, if there's a good lesson to be learned here, it's put a password into your cell phone.
Yeah.
Because had there been a password here, and the government would have then had to obtain a warrant for sure, they couldn't have gotten the password.
Yeah.
And then there's a question of whether giving the password is self-incrimination. So I assume that, you know.
That might be.
These are all not facts that are before us, but I think that, I mean, it's.
I would say the other lesson to learn is don't try to deal ecstasy and then kidnap somebody. But, you know, because none of that.
That's obvious. Okay.
Don't call mother and say bring it back. Because she may bring the police. Now, let's talk about the closing argument, though.
Okay.
The presumption of innocence has been removed. How can you defend that?
Well, I think that if you read the whole sentence, what they say is, and what the prosecutor says is, after hearing all the evidence, you will see that the cloak of the presumption of innocence has been removed. And then later what he says
is, how do you remove the presumption?
By the government establishing beyond a reasonable doubt, by convincing the jury that the defendant is guilty.
Well, the presumption still exists. It's just that.
The presumption is overcome.
Yeah.
Bad choice of words.
Yes. And I would say, I mean, I actually think that if you read, especially the second sentence, which is very confusing, and I use the word inartful, when he's talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt that leaves you firmly convinced that the defendant is guilty, and they say, and then he says, if you are so convinced, which sort of looks forward, and agree that your duty was to find the defendant guilty, which is sort of past tense, the presumption.
I know where you are, but let's fast forward to the next page, because then, so far, then what is reasonable doubt, he says. The instruction says it's not all doubt. It's proof that leaves you firmly convinced the defendant is guilty. And if you are so convinced you agree your duty was to find the evidence guilty, ladies and gentlemen, the evidence is there. The presumption of innocence that the defendant enjoyed a week ago is gone.
If you are so convinced. The rule is the presumption of innocence goes with the jury into the jury room as they begin their deliberations, right? And it is the government's burden to overcome that presumption by firmly convincing the jurors that the defendant is guilty. If you are so convinced, the prosecutor says, and your duty is to find the defendant guilty, the presumption of innocence is gone. If you're looking at it in the future. Now, here's what I will say. Two things I will say. One is, I would advise prosecutors just not to even get into the whole presumption of innocence and the cloak of innocence and all of that. I think that it's just a better practice would be not to go there.
When I was a district court judge, I'm sure Judge Ezra has heard it too.
But the fact of the matter is these sentences can be read two ways. I mean, they can be read as inartful but fairly accurate statements of the law, or they can be read in a way that potentially would lead to some confusion.
Right, and if the jurors took it literally that presumption didn't apply, that would be harmful error.
And the reason that I would say that they didn't do that is that if you choose to read these sentences in the way the defendant is requesting, which is such that they could possibly be confusing, then you have to follow the rule of looking at these statements in the context of the whole closing statement, in the context of the jury instructions. I mean, clearly at the time, knowing that these can be viewed a couple of different ways, the defendant made no objection.
No,
I mean, the defense attorney sitting there, I mean, but the defense attorney sitting there who could have interpreted it one of two ways didn't think that it was confusing enough to raise an objection about it. The district court judge Judge McKibben gave a very clear and accurate instruction about the presumption of innocence, about proof beyond a reasonable doubt. There was no request from the jury there wasn't any question from the jury saying, what does this mean? I mean, I think that in the context of the jury instruction and the whole closing argument, it just can't be said that this plainly influenced the jury to make a decision that it wouldn't have made otherwise.
Last issue, speedy trial.
Speedy trial, I mean, frankly, the defense counsel stipulated to the facts justifying every continuance. Judge McKibben signed written orders finding the facts justifying the continuances. The defendant is saying now, and actually said prior to trial, that he had disagreed with his attorney and he was trying to, he wanted his attorney to file it. He had told his attorney that he didn't want continuances. And the district court had a hearing about that. I mean, after appointing new counsel for the defendant, because the defendant wanted to raise an issue that the first lawyer didn't think there was a legal basis for, so he found irreconcilable differences, had a hearing at which the defendant said, I told my lawyer I didn't want any continuances. And the judge said to the former lawyer, what do you think about that? And he says, well, there's attorney-client issues here. And so the judge turns to the defendant and says, I assume you waive the attorney-client issues so your lawyer can testify about this. And the defendant said, no, I won't waive attorney-client privilege. And so Judge McKibben is like, well, what am I supposed to do here? I mean, he has made representations to the court that he's consulted with you. You're saying that he didn't, but you won't let him tell me what really happened. And those, I think it was absolutely reasonable in those circumstances for the district court to exercise its discretion and credit the representations that the attorney had made in filings in court and to discredit the statements that the defendant was making.
But there were some filings that didn't contain the stipulation or the statement that the defendants had consented.
Yeah.
There were about three of those.
There were. At least two that I know of, the first two in 2006. And I think I actually don't agree. I mean, I agree with the defendant when he says that it's not a matter of the defendant consenting or not. It's not a matter of the defendant consenting or not. It's a matter of whether there's a legitimate factual basis for a legitimate need to continue the trial. And if the attorney thinks that there is, the attorney who is charged with strategic decisions and case management, if the defendant disagrees with that, I think their choice is to get a new attorney, which is eventually this defendant did get a new attorney. But I do think that that if the attorney in his professional judgment felt that additional time was needed, and as I say, this case was evolving as defendants were being identified, as defendants were pleading guilty and cooperating, there was additional discovery that was turned over.
These were the precise continuances that Judge McKibben was attempting to elicit information about from the defendant, from which he would not allow his
exactly. Work. I mean, he was trying to elicit information about all of the continuances. I see
right.
My time
I mean,
is up.
When the, no, but just okay. To finish the thought. What you say makes perfect sense, unless the defendant personally asserts a right to a speedy trial pro se, which he did.
He did in 13 months yeah. after the trial. Now, he says he points to two things as evidence that he was raising it earlier. Mm-hmm. One is a letter or a request that he wrote to the jail folks to get the address of the federal district court so that he could write the judge a letter and say, I want a speedy trial. So he got this request, which it shows they gave him the address of the district court. There's nothing in the record to indicate that he actually wrote to the district court and made that request known. The other was a very colorful conversation that he had with a friend of his, where he's asserting that, you know, he's explaining to his friend that the Supreme Court says, you know, you have this right to a speedy trial, and he's going to be sure that, you know, his lawyer does that. But that, you know, there's no way that Judge McKibb and that the district court could have known about that until the defendant personally raised it with the district court. And as soon as he did, Judge McKibben took action, which, of course, required an additional continuance when he got a new lawyer. And the defendant personally said, yes, I understand that.
Okay. Any further questions? Thanks for your rebuttal.
Can I ask you a quick question? Why isn't it harmless error for the with respect to the cell phone? Now, I understand it was a video, and that's always pretty powerful evidence, but you have co-defendants all over the place, as well as the victim, testifying to precisely the same exact thing.
Right. Yeah. No, there's no question about that. There's no dispute that the co-defendants that pled guilty in this case ended up turning government witness, came in and put the blame on my client, and there's no disputing the fact, because it's a fact that the victim took the stand and testified that, you know, my client had participated and gave his testimony. That's absolutely true. But the reverse then is, if you have all that, then why admit the videotape? Why is it so important that it come in? Obviously, to them, it was pretty important also. There was a defense that was presented, an affirmative defense of duress. And you know, as we put in the briefs, we personally believe that the videotape, along with the testimony and everything else, but the videotape also was damning because of that very reason, is that the only voice on the videotape is the voice of my client. Now, he had an explanation for that in his testimony or whatever. But I believe that, coupled with the other trial error that we raised, which the presumption of innocence is gone, and some other things that happened in this case, that's a determination to be made by this court, whether or not it would or would not be harmless.
On the presumption question, why wasn't that cured, or at least by the instructions given by Judge McKibben? And, I mean, it's a plain error review, so.
Sure. It is a plain error review. Absolutely. And she's right. Defense counsel did not object. The reason we argue that the instructions did not cure that is, one, I don't believe, and I may be mistaken on this, so I apologize, I don't think there was ever an instruction on the presumption of innocence. There was an instruction about what reasonable doubt is, and there was an instruction that what counsel states in closing argument is not evidence. That's a useless instruction anyways, because we're not talking about evidence. We're talking about instructing them on what the law is, not the evidence in this case. Those instructions were given before closing argument, not after. So what you have, the last thing this jury hears is the prosecutor, who, as we quoted from Supreme Court case law, has a particularly important role, even in the eyes of the public, as to them representing the government and what they say and being sort of gospel truth, so to speak, telling the jury, if you believe your duty is to find the defendant guilty, not if you believe your duty, he says, the judge pointed out here, what is reasonable doubt? The instruction says it's not all doubt. This is on page 203 of the record. It's proof that leaves you firmly convinced the defendant is guilty. And if you are so convinced and you agree that your duty was to find the defendant guilty, well, that's not their duty. Their duty is to listen to the evidence and apply the law to the facts. And then they decide when they go in whether or not. And then he shifts the burden at the end there, and he says, now you've been here, you've heard everything, and the only thing you have to counter the evidence, right, that the government has put on is the unsupported testimony of this defendant, defendant doesn't have to present any testimony, any evidence in this case. So clearly it's not inartful or inelegant. He's telling them, look, we did our case. We won. It's gone. There's no presumption here. This guy's guilty of sin. And your duty is to find him guilty.
Well, he didn't exactly say that. What he said was that
he was hopeless.
Yeah. He by the weight of the evidence, he had lost his cloak, yep. Essentially. Terrible way to put it, but not necessarily inaccurate.
Okay.
You're over your time a bit. Do you want to quickly address speedy trial?
Very quickly, there were two things I wanted to do. First, I promised the prosecutor that I would do this in the reply brief as I was preparing for oral argument today on page 5. In rebuttal to an argument that they raised about how the third superseding indictment that was filed in November 30th of 2005, restarted the Speedy Trial Act clock. And so we say, well, there are some exceptions to that if the delay was unreasonable, and we raise several arguments in there. On that page, it makes it seem as if what happened is that the government in October comes in and says, look, we're looking at some evidence, and we're probably going to be filing in the near future a superseding indictment that includes a 924C count. Mm-hmm. Okay? And then in the brief, as we point out, this happens in October. November 1, Jacob Belford, who is the additional defendant that's added by the third superseding indictment, claims that he's provided with a copy of a superseding indictment. Now, presumably it's the indictment that adds him as a defendant, because then he says he calls up the FBI agent and says, look, I want to cooperate and blah, blah, blah. That happens November 1, according to Belford. He gets this superseding indictment. There is a second superseding indictment that's filed the day after, on November 2, 2005. It does, in fact, have a 924C count and does not include the defendant, Jacob Belford. It just added the 924C count. Then Belford is added as a defendant on November 30th with an indictment that is actually filed in the court. So I just wanted to clarify that our brief may make it sound like there was never a superseding indictment that was filed that had this 924C count, when in fact there was. Very quickly, it seemed that the court was very concerned about consent and so forth. We would argue that, as has been explained here over and over, that doesn't really matter. What matters here is that the district court, by Ninth Circuit case law, has certain constraints. It has to limit ends of justice, continuances, and the second is it has to make factual determinations on the record justifying those things. And one of our main arguments is that was not done in this case. You can't just simply put Alvarez, I think, is one of the cases that we cite to. It's not a matter of just submitting a stipulation and the court signing off on it and saying okay. The court has to make factual determination justifying an ends of justice continuance. It's not to be used, as this court has said, every single time as a general exclusion. It is to be rarely used. And in this case, you have, if you take a look at all the findings and the stipulations, they're all over the place. And sometimes you have them going just into court and saying, he's like, what do the parties want? Well, we want a continuance. We're looking at 924C count possible. Okay, we'll continue it. How about this time? Well, we're not prepared to go to trial, the government even says in one of them. So because we were absent, we don't have our witnesses ready, and the court says, well, okay, I've got a medical reason. And so he's just continuing it willy-nilly every single time.
But by agreeing, there were reasons in every single one of these.
There were reasons given, but not every single one of them.
We've agreed among ourselves we want a continuance, and the judge says, okay.
Yeah.
That didn't happen. There were always reasons why. You just stated them on the record.
Well, I would say that there were some reasons sometimes, and sometimes it was just a parroting of the language of the statute that says ends of justice, you know, blah, 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 with no factual findings. And this court has stated in cases like Ramirez-Cortez that when you're doing an ends of justice continuance, you don't just simply, you know, look at it and say, well, okay, I'm going to sign that stipulation. You guys agree that the ends of justice, you know, say, okay. It says in Cortez and in Lloyd, Ramirez-Cortez, the district court must conduct a particularized appropriate inquiry about why the parties need the continuance. Do they want one? How long the delay is required? Adjustments that can be made with respect to the trial calendars or other plans? And the continuances, whether they would, in fact, outweigh the best interest of the defendant in a public and the public in a speedy trial. So it's not just simply looking at a stipulation saying, well, great, you guys want it, and you guys have put in here some reasons. Some of them just say it's so ordered with no factual finding. at all by anybody. So
I think we have your argument. Thanks so much for your argument. The case just will be submitted.